We've worked together. This is what we've done. Eliminated overpopulation. Restored the quality of urban life and the ecological balance of the planet. Eliminated cancer as a major killer. He began to bend his strong gray fingers down, enumerating. Eliminated the color problem, racial hatred. Eliminated war. Eliminated the risk of species deterioration and the fostering of deleterious gene stocks. Eliminated, no, say in process of eliminating, poverty, economic equality, the class war, all over the world. What else? Mental illness, maladjustment to reality. That'll take a while, but we've made the first steps already, under Hurad direction. The reduction of human misery, physical and psychic, and the constant increase of valid individual self-expression is an ongoing thing, a constant progress. Progress, George! We've made more progress in 6 weeks than humanity made in 600,000 years. Orr felt that all these arguments should be answered. He began, "But where's democratic government got to? People can't choose anything at all anymore for themselves. Why is everything so shoddy? Why is everybody so joyless? You can't even tell people apart. And the younger they are, the more that's so. This business of world state bringing up all the children in those centers." But Haber interrupted, really angry. "The child centers were your invention, not mine. I simply outlined the desiderata to you among the suggestions for a dream, as I always do. I tried to suggest how to implement some of them, but those suggestions never seem to take hold, or they get twisted out of all recognition by your damned primary process thinking. You don't have to tell me that you resist and resent everything I'm trying to accomplish for humanity. You know, that's been obvious from the start. Every step forward that I force you to take, you cancel. You cripple with the deviousness or stupidity of the means your dreams take to realize it. You try each time to take a step backward. Your own drives are totally negative. If you weren't under strong hypnotic compulsion when you dream, you'd have reduced the world to ashes weeks ago. Look what you almost did that one night when you ran off with that woman lawyer." "She's dead," Orr said. "Good. She was a destructive influence on you, irresponsible. You have no social conscience, no altruism. You're a moral jellyfish. I have to instill social responsibility in you hypnotically every time, and every time it's thwarted, spoiled. That's what happened with the child centers. I suggested that the nuclear family, being the prime shaper of neurotic personality structures, there were certain ways in which it might, in an ideal society, be modified. Your dream simply grabbed at the crudest interpretation of these, mixed it up with cheap utopian concepts, or cynical anti-utopian concepts, perhaps, and produced the centers, which, all the same, are better than what they replaced. There is very little schizophrenia in this world. Did you know that? It's a rare disease." Haber's dark eyes shone, his lips grinned. "Things are better than they were once," Orr said, abandoning hope of discussion. "But as you go on, they get worse. I'm not trying to thwart you. It's that you're trying to do something that can't be done. I have this gift, I know that, and I know my obligation to it, to use it only when I must, when there is no other alternative. There are alternatives now. I've got to stop." "We can't stop. We've just begun. We're just beginning to get any control at all over this power of yours. I'm within sight of doing so, and I will do so. No personal fears can stand in the way of the good that can be done for all men with this new capacity of the human brain." Haber was speech-making. Orr looked at him, but the opaque eyes gazing straight at him did not return his look, did not see him. The speech went on. "What I'm doing is making this new capacity replicable. There's an analogy with the invention of printing, with the application of any new technological or scientific concept. If the experiment or technique cannot be repeated successfully by others, it is of no use. Similarly, the E-State, so long as it was locked into the brain of a single man, was no more use to humanity than a key locked inside a room or a single sterile genius mutation. But I'll have the means of getting the key out of that room, and that key will be as great a milestone in human evolution as the development of the reasoning brain itself. Any brain capable of using it, deserving of using it, will be able to, when a suitable, trained, prepared subject enters the E-State under the augmenter stimulus, he will be under complete auto-hypnotic control. Nothing will be left to chance, to random impulse, to irrational narcissistic whim. There will be none of this tension between your will to nihilism and my will to progress, your nirvana wishes and my conscious, careful planning for the good of all. When I have made sure of my techniques, then you'll be free to go, absolutely free. And since you've claimed all along that all you want is to be free of responsibility, incapable of dreaming effectively, then I'll promise that my very first effective dream will include your cure. You'll never have an effective dream again. Orr had risen. He stood still, looking at Haber. His face was calm, but intensely alert and centered. You will control your own dreams, he said, by yourself, no one helping or supervising you. I've controlled yours for weeks now, in my own case, and of course I'll be the first subject of my own experiment. That's an absolute ethical obligation. In my own case, the control will be complete. I tried auto-hypnosis before I ever used the dream-suppressing drugs. Yes, you mentioned that before. You failed, of course. The question of a resistant subject achieving successful auto-suggestion is an interesting one, but this was no test of it whatever. You're not a professional psychologist. You're not a trained hypnotist, and you were already emotionally disturbed about the whole issue. You got nowhere, of course. But I am a professional, and I know precisely what I'm doing. I can auto-suggest an entire dream and dream it in every detail precisely as thought out by my waking mind. I've done so every night this past week, getting in training. When the augmenter synchronizes the generalized E-state pattern with my own D-state, such dreams will be effectivized. And then... The lips within the curly beard parted in a straining, staring smile, a grin of ecstasy that made Orr turn away as if he had seen something never meant to be seen, both terrifying and pathetic. Then this world will be like heaven, and men will be like gods. We are already, Orr said, but the other paid no heed. There is nothing to fear. The dangerous time, had we known it, was when you alone possessed the capacity for e-dreaming and didn't know what to do with it. You hadn't come to me. If you hadn't been sent into trained scientific hands, who knows what might have happened. But you were here, and I was here. As they say, genius consists in being in the right time in the right place. He boomed a laugh. So now there's nothing to fear, and it's all out of your hands. I know, scientifically and morally, what I'm doing and how to do it. I know where I'm going.
Volcanoes emit fire, Orr murmured.
What?
May I go now?
Tomorrow at 5.
I'll come, Orr said, and left.
Chapter 10
Il dessin réveillé l'autre côte du rêve.
Hugo, Contemplations. It was only 3 o'clock, and he should have gone back to his office in the Parks Department and finished up the plans for Southeast Suburban Play Areas. But he didn't. He gave it one thought and dismissed it. Although his memory assured him that he had held that position for 5 years now, he disbelieved his memory. The job had no reality to him. It was not work he had to do. It was not his job. He was aware that in thus relegating to irreality a major portion of the only reality, the only existence that he in fact did have, he was running exactly the same risk the insane mind runs.
the loss of the sense of free will. He knew that insofar as one denies what is, one is possessed by what is not, the compulsions, the fantasies, the terrors that flock to fill the void. But the void was there. This life lacked realness. It was hollow. The dream, creating where there was no necessity to create, had worn thin and sleazy. If this was being, perhaps the void was better. He would accept the monsters and the necessities beyond reason. He would go home and take no drugs, but sleep and dream what dreams might come. He got off the funicular downtown, but instead of taking the trolley, he set out walking toward his own district. He had always liked to walk. Along past Lovejoy Park, a piece of the old freeway was still standing, a huge ramp, probably dating from the last frenetic convulsions of highway mania in the 70s. It must have led up to the Marquam Bridge, once, but now ended abruptly in mid-air, 30 feet above Front Avenue. It had not been destroyed when the city was cleaned up and rebuilt after the plague years, perhaps because it was so large, so useless, and so ugly as to be, to the American eye, invisible. There it stood, and a few bushes had taken root up on the roadway, while underneath it a huddle of buildings had grown up, like swallows' nests in a cliff. In this rather dowdy and non-committal bit of the city, there were still small shops, independent markets, unappetizing little restaurants, and so on, struggling along despite the stringencies of total consumer product equity rationing and the overwhelming competition of the great WPC marts and outlets, through which 90% of the world trade was now channeled. One of these shops under the ramp was a second-hand store. The sign above the windows said Antiques, and a poorly lettered, peeling sign painted on the glass said Junk. There was some squat handmade pottery in one window, an old rocker with a moth-eaten paisley shawl draped over it in the other, and scattered around these main displays all kinds of cultural litter, a horseshoe, a hand-wound clock, something enigmatic from a diary, a framed photograph of President Eisenhower, a slightly chipped glass globe containing 3 Ecuadorian coins, a plastic toilet seat cover decorated with baby crabs and seaweed, a well-thumbed rosary, and a stack of old hi-fi 45 RPM records marked GD-CND, but obviously scratched. Just the sort of place, Orr thought, where Heather's mother might have worked for a while. Moved by the impulse, he went in. It was cool and rather dark inside. A leg of the ramp formed one wall, a high blank dark expanse of concrete like the wall of an undersea cave. From the receding prospect of shadows, bulky furniture, decrepit acres of action paintings, and fake antique spinning wheels, now becoming genuinely antique, though still useless, from these tenebrous reaches of no man's things, a huge form emerged, seeming to float forward slowly, silent and reptilian. The proprietor was an alien. It raised its crooked left elbow and said, "Good day. Do you wish an object?"
"Thanks, I was just looking."
"Please continue this activity," the proprietor said. It withdrew a little way into the shadows and stood quite motionless. Orr looked at the light play on some ratty old peacock feathers, observed a 1950 home movie projector, a blue and white sake set, a heap of Mad magazines priced quite high. He hefted a solid steel hammer and admired its balance. It was a well-made tool, a good thing.
"Is this your own choice?" he asked the proprietor, wondering what the aliens themselves might prize from all this flotsam of the affluent years of America.
"What comes is acceptable," the alien replied, a congenial point of view.
"I wonder if you'd tell me something. In your language, what is the meaning of the word Eoklu?"
The proprietor came slowly forward again, edging the broad shell-like armor carefully among fragile objects. "Incommunicable,"
Language used for communication with individual persons will not contain other forms of relationship. Jor-Jor. The right hand, a great greenish flipper-like extremity, came forward in a slow and perhaps tentative fashion.
Tiwak, Enbe, Enbe.
Or shook hands with it.
It stood immobile, apparently regarding him, though no eyes were visible inside the dark, tinted, vapor-filled headpiece.
If it was a headpiece, was there, in fact, any substantial form within that green carapace, that mighty armor? He didn't know. He felt, however, completely at ease with Tiwak Enbe Enbe.
"I don't suppose," he said on impulse again, "that you ever knew anyone named Lelok?"
"Lelok, no. Do you seek Lelok?"
"I have lost Lelok."
"Crossings in mist," the alien observed.
"That's about it," Orr said.
He picked up from the crowded table before him a white bust of Franz Schubert, about 2 inches high, probably a piano teacher's prize to a pupil. On the base, the pupil had written, "What, me worry?" Schubert's face was mild and impassive, a tiny bespeckled Buddha.
"How much is this?" Orr asked.
5 new cents, replied Tiwak Enbe Enbe. Orr produced a fed peep nickel.
"Is there any way to control Iaklu, to make it go the way it ought to go?"
The alien took the nickel and sidled majestically over to a chrome-plated cash register, which Orr had assumed was for sale as an antique. It rang up the sale on the register and stood still a while. "One swallow does not make a summer," it said. "Many hands make light work." It stopped again, apparently not satisfied with this effort at bridging the communication gap. It stood still for half a minute, then went to the front window, and with precise, stiff, careful movements, picked out one of the antique disc records displayed there and brought it to Orr. It was a Beatles record, with a little help from my friends.
"Gift," it said. "Is it acceptable?"
"Yes," Orr said, and took the record.
"Thank you. Thanks very much. It's very kind of you. I am grateful."
"Pleasure," said the alien. Though the mechanically produced voice was toneless and the armor impassive, Orr was sure that Tiwak Enbe Enbe was in fact pleased. He himself was moved.
"I can play this on my landlord's machine. He has an old disc phonograph," he said. "Thank you very much."
They shook hands again, and he left. After all, he thought as he walked on toward Corbett Avenue, it's not surprising that the aliens are on my side. In a sense, I invented them. I have no idea in what sense, of course, but they definitely weren't around until I dreamed they were, until I let them be, so that there is, there always was, a connection between us. Of course, his thoughts proceeded, also at a walking pace, if that's true, then the whole world, as it now is, should be on my side, because I dreamed a lot of it up, too. Well, after all, it is on my side. That is, I'm a part of it, not separate from it. I walk on the ground, and the ground's walked on by me. I breathe the air and change it. I am entirely interconnected with the world. Only Haber's different, and more different with each dream. He's against me. My connection with him is negative, and that aspect of the world which he's responsible for, which he ordered me to dream, that's what I feel alienated from, powerless against. It's not that he's evil. He's right. One ought to try to help other people. But that analogy with snake bite serum was false. He was talking about one person meeting another person in pain. That's different. Perhaps what I did in April 4 years ago, was justified. But his thoughts shied away, as always, from the burned place.
You have to help another person, but it's not right to play God with masses of people. To be God, you have to know what you're doing. And to do any good at all, Just believing you're right and your motives are good isn't enough. You have to be in touch. He isn't in touch. No one else, no thing even, has an existence of its own for him. He sees the world only as a means to his end. It doesn't make any difference if his end is good. Means are all we've got. He can't accept. He can't let be. He can't let go. He is insane. He could take us all with him, out of touch, if he did manage to dream as I do. What am I to do? He reached the old house on Corbett as he reached that question. He stopped off in the basement to borrow the old-fashioned phonograph from Manny Ahrens, the manager. This involved sharing a pot of tea. Manny always brewed it for Orr, since Orr had never smoked and couldn't inhale without coughing. They discussed world affairs a little. Manny hated the sports shows. He stayed home and watched the WPC educational shows for pre-child center children every afternoon.
The alligator puppet, Doobie-Doo, he's a real cool cat.
There were long gaps in the conversation, reflections of the large holes in the fabric of Manny's mind, worn thin by the application of innumerable chemicals over the years. But there was peace and privacy in his grubby basement, and weak cannabis tea had a mildly relaxing effect on Orr. At last he lugged the phonograph upstairs and plugged it into a wall socket in his bare living room. He put the record on and then held the needle arm suspended over the turning disc. What did he want? He didn't know. Help, he supposed. Well, what came would be acceptable, as Tiwak Enbe Enbe had said. He set the needle carefully on the outer groove and lay down beside the phonograph on the dusty floor. Do you need anybody? I need somebody to love. The machine was automatic. When it had played the record, it grumbled softly a moment, clicked its innards, and returned the needle to the first groove. I get by with a little help, with a little help from my friends. During the 11th replay, Orr fell sound asleep. Awakening in the high, bare, twilight room, Heather was disconcerted. Where on earth? She had been asleep. Gone to sleep sitting on the floor with her legs stretched out and her back against the piano. Marijuana always made her sleepy, and stupid, too, but you couldn't hurt Manny's feelings and refuse it, the poor old pothead. George lay flat as a skinned cat on the floor, right by the phonograph, which was slowly eating its way through, with a little help, right down to the turntable. She cut the volume down slowly, then stopped the machine. George never stirred. His lips were slightly parted, his eyes firmly closed. How funny that they had both gone to sleep listening to the music. She got up off her knees and went out to the kitchen to see what was for dinner. Oh, for Christ's sake, pig liver. It was nourishing and the best value you could get for 3 meat ration stamps by weight. She had picked it up at the mart yesterday. Well, cut real thin and fried with salt pork and onions. Yuck. Oh, well, she was hungry enough to eat pig liver, and George wasn't a picky man. If it was decent food, he ate and enjoyed it, and if it was lousy pig liver, he ate it. Praise God from whom all blessings flow, including good-natured men. As she set the kitchen table and put 2 potatoes and half a cabbage on to cook, she paused from time to time. She did feel odd, disoriented. From the damn pot and going to sleep on the floor at all hours, no doubt. George came in, disheveled and dusty-shirted. He stared at her. She said, "Well, good morning." He stood looking at her and smiling, a broad, radiant smile of pure joy. She had never received so great a compliment in her life. She was abashed by that joy, which she had caused. "My dear wife," he said, taking her hands. He looked at them, palms and backs, and put them up against his face. "You should be brown," he said, and to her dismay, she saw tears in his eyes. For a moment, just that moment, she had a notion of what was going on. She recalled being brown, and remembered the silence in the cabin at night and the sound of the creek and many other things all in a flash. But George was a more urgent consideration. She was holding him as he held her. "You're worn out," she said. "You're upset. You fell asleep on the floor. It's that bastard Haber. Don't go back to him. Just don't. I don't care what he does. We'll take it to court. We'll appeal it. Even if he slaps a constraint injunction on you and sticks you in Linton, we'll get you a different shrink and get you out again. You can't go on with him. He's destroying you."
"Nobody can destroy me," he said, and laughed a little, deep in his chest, almost a sob. "Not so long as I have a little help from my friends. I'll go back. It's not going to last much longer. It's not me I'm worried about anymore. But don't worry."
They hung on to each other, in touch at all available surfaces, absolutely unified, while the liver and onions sizzled in the pan.
"I fell asleep, too," she said, into his neck. "I got so groggy typing up old Rudy's dumb letters. But that's a good record you bought. I loved the Beatles when I was a kid, but the government stations never play them anymore."
"It was a present," George said, but the liver popped in the pan, and she had to disengage herself and see to it. At dinner, George watched her. She watched him a good bit, too. They had been married 7 months. They said nothing of any importance. They washed up the dishes and went to bed. In bed, they made love. Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made, like bread, remade all the time, made new. When it was made, they lay in each other's arms, holding love, asleep. In her sleep, Heather heard the roaring of a creek full of the voices of unborn children singing. In his sleep, George saw the depths of the open sea. Heather was the secretary of an aged and osseous legal partnership, Ponder and Rudy. When she got off work at 4:30 the next day, Friday, she didn't take the monorail and trolley home, but rode the funicular up to Washington Park. She had told George she might come meet him at Hurad, since his therapy session wasn't till 5, and after it they might go back downtown together and eat at one of the WPC restaurants on the International Mall. "It'll be all right," he told her, understanding her motive and meaning that he would be all right. She replied, "I know, but it would be fun to eat out, and I saved some stamps. We haven't tried the Casa Boliviana yet." She got to the Hurad Tower early and waited on the vast marble steps. He came on the next car. She saw him get off with others whom she did not see, a short, neatly made man, very self-contained, with an amiable expression. He moved well, though he stooped a little, like most desk workers. When he saw her eyes, which were clear and light, he seemed to grow lighter, and he smiled again. Again, that heartbreaking smile of unmitigated joy. She loved him violently. If Haber hurt him again, she would go in there and tear Haber into little bits. Violent feelings were foreign to her, usually, but not where George was concerned. And anyhow, today, for some reason, she felt different from usual. She felt bolder, harder. She had said, "shit," aloud, twice at work, making old Mr. Rudy flinch. She hardly ever said "shit" before aloud, and she hadn't intended to do so either time, and yet she had done it, as if it were a habit too old to break. "Hello, George," she said. "Hello," he said, taking her hands. "You are beautiful, beautiful." How could anybody think this man was sick? All right, so he had funny dreams. That was better than being plain mean and hateful, like about one quarter of the people she had ever met. "It's already 5, she said. "I'll wait down here. If it rains, I'll be in the lobby. It's like Napoleon's tomb in there, all that black marble and stuff. It's nice out here, though. You can hear the lions roaring down in the zoo." "Come on up with me," he said. "It's raining already." In fact, it was, the endless warm drizzle of spring, the ice of Antarctica falling softly on the heads of the children of those responsible for melting it. "He's got a nice waiting room. You'll probably be sharing it with a mess of Fed Peep bigwigs and 3 or 4 chiefs of state. all dancing attendance on the director of Hurad, and I have to go crawling through and get shown in ahead of them every damn time. Dr. Haber's tame psycho, his exhibition, his token patient. He was steering her through the big lobby under the Pantheon Dome onto moving walkways up an incredible, apparently endless spiral escalator. "Hurad really runs the world as is," he said. "I can't help wondering why Haber needs any other form of power. He's got enough, God knows. Why can't he stop here? I suppose it's like Alexander the Great, needing new worlds to conquer. I never did understand that. How was work today?" He was tense, that's why he was talking so much, but he didn't seem depressed or distressed as he had for weeks. Something had restored his natural equanimity. She had never really believed that he could lose it for long, lose his way, get out of touch. Yet he had been wretched, increasingly so. Now he was not, and the change was so sudden and complete that she wondered what, in fact, had worked it. All she could date it from was their sitting down in the still unfurnished living room to listen to that nutty and subtle Beatles song last evening, and both falling asleep. From then on, he had been himself again. Nobody was in Haber's big, sleek waiting room. George said his name to a desk-like thing by the door, an auto-receptionist, he explained to Heather. She was making a nervous funny about did they have auto-eroticists, too, when a door opened and Haber stood in the doorway. She had met him only once, and briefly, when he first took George as a patient. She had forgotten what a big man he was, how big a beard he had, how drastically impressive he looked. "Come on in, George," he thundered. She was awed. She cowered. He noticed her. "Mrs. Orr, glad to see you. Glad you came. You come on in, too."
"Oh, no, I just..."
"Oh, yes. Do you realize that this is probably George's last session here? Did he tell you? Tonight, we wind it up. You certainly ought to be present. Come on. I've let my staff out early. Expect you saw the stampede on the down escalator. Felt like having the place to myself tonight. That's it. Sit down there."
He went on. There was no need to say anything meaningful in reply. She was fascinated by Haber's demeanor, the kind of exaltation he exuded. She hadn't remembered what a masterful, genial person he was, larger than life-size. It was unbelievable, really, that such a man, a world leader and a great scientist, should have spent all these weeks of personal therapy on George, who wasn't anybody. But of course, George's case was very important, research-wise.
"One last session," he was saying, while adjusting something in a computerish-looking thing in the wall at the head of the couch. "One last controlled dream, and then, I think, we've got the problem licked. You game, George?"
He used her husband's name often. She remembered George's saying a couple of weeks ago, "He keeps calling me by my name. I think it's to remind himself that there's someone else present."
"Sure I'm game," George said, and sat down on the couch, lifting his face a little. He glanced once at Heather and smiled.
Haber at once started attaching the little things on wires to his head, parting the thick hair to do so. Heather remembered that process from her own brain printing, part of the battery of tests and records made on every Fed Peep citizen. It made her uneasy to see it done to her husband, as if the electrode things were little suction cups that would drain the thoughts out of George's head and turn them into scribbles on a piece of paper, the meaningless writing of the mad. George's face now wore a look of extreme concentration. What was he thinking? Haber put his hand on George's throat suddenly, as if about to throttle him, and reaching out with the other hand, started a tape which spoke the hypnotist's spiel in his own voice. "You are entering the hypnotic state." Within a few seconds, he stopped it and tested for hypnosis. George was under.
"Okay," Haber said, and paused, evidently pondering.
Huge, like a grizzly bear reared up on its hind legs, he stood there between her and the slight, passive figure on the couch.
"Now listen, George, and remember what I say. You are deeply hypnotized,
and will follow explicitly all instructions I give you. You're going to go to sleep when I tell you to, and you'll dream. You'll have an effective dream. You'll dream that you are completely normal, that you are like everybody else. You'll dream that you once had, or thought you had, a capacity for effective dreaming, but that this is no longer true. Your dreams from henceforth will be just like everybody else's, meaningful to you alone, having no effect on outward reality. You'll dream all this, whatever symbolism you use to express the dream, its effective content will be that you can no longer dream effectively. It will be a pleasant dream, and you'll wake up when I say your name 3 times, feeling alert and well. After this dream, you will never dream effectively again. Now lie back. Get comfortable. You're going to sleep. You're asleep. Antwerp. As he said this last word, George's lips moved and he said something in the faint, remote voice of the sleep talker. Heather could not hear what he said, but she thought at once of last night. She had been nearly asleep, curled up next to him, when he had said something aloud. Air per annum, it sounded like. What? She had said, and he had said nothing. He was asleep, as he was now. Her heart contracted within her as she watched him lying there, his hands quiet at his sides, vulnerable. Haber had risen and now pressed a white button on the side of the machine at the head of the couch. Some of the electrode wires went to it, and some to the EEG machine, which she recognized. The thing in the wall must be the augmenter, the thing all the research was about. Haber came over to her, where she sat sunk deep in a huge leather armchair. Real leather. She had forgotten what real leather felt like. It was like the vinyl leathers, but more interesting to the fingers. She was frightened. She did not understand what was going on. She looked up askance at the big man standing before her, the bear shaman god. "This is the culmination, Mrs. Orr," he was saying in a lowered voice, "of a long series of suggested dreams. We've been building toward this session, this dream, for weeks now. I'm glad you came. I didn't think to ask you, but your presence is an added boon in making him feel completely secure and trustful. He knows I can't pull any tricks with you around, right? Actually, I'm pretty confident of success. It'll do the trick. The dependency on sleeping drugs will be quite broken once the obsessive fear of dreaming is erased. It's purely a matter of conditioning. I've got to keep an eye on that EEG. He'll be dreaming now." Quick and massive, he moved across the room. She sat still, watching George's calm face, from which the expression of concentration, all expression, was gone. So he might look in death. Dr. Haber was busy with his machines, restlessly busy, bowing over them, adjusting them, watching them. He paid no heed at all to George. "There," he said softly, not to her, Heather thought. He was his own audience. "That's it. Now a little break. Second stage sleep for a bit between dreams." He did something to the equipment in the wall. "Then we'll run a little test." He came over to her again. She wished he would really ignore her instead of pretending to talk to her. He seemed not to know the uses of silence. "Your husband has been of inestimable service to our research here, Mrs. Orr, a unique patient. What we've learned about the nature of dreaming and the employment of dreams in both positive and negative conditioning therapy will be of literally inestimable value in every walk of life. You know what HURAD stands for. Human Utility, Research and Development. Well, what we've learned from this case will be of immense, literally immense human utility. An amazing thing to develop out of what appeared to be a routine case of minor drug abuse. The most amazing thing about it is that the hacks down at the med school had the wits to notice anything special in the case and refer it up to me. You seldom get so much acuteness in academic clinical psychologists." His eye had been on his watch all along,
and he now said,
"Well, back to baby,"
and swiftly recrossed the room. He diddled with the augmenter thing again and said out loud,
"George, you're still asleep, but you can hear me.